On this week's 51%, there's an exhibit featuring the daughter of the founder of the Hudson River School. Could changes be afoot to ensure women allow pelvic exams when under anesthesia?
I think a lot of folks would be deeply, deeply disturbed by knowing that this might have happened to them or could possibly happen to them.
And we meet a university's first woman police chief. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. An artist with deep roots in upstate New York is being celebrated with the first exhibition of her work in more than a century. 51%'s Dave Lucas reports.
In celebration of Women's History Month, the Thomas Cole National Historic Site in Catskill is presenting The Art of Emily Cole. Emily Cole was the daughter of renowned Hudson River School founder Thomas Cole. She was ahead of her time as she followed in his footsteps while earning her own place in American art. Kate Mancaneri is curator and director of exhibitions and collections at the Cole site.
Emily Cole was one of five of Cole's children, and she was the only one who displayed interest in painting. And we are always thinking about what happened here at this house, and we're fascinated by Emily's paintings.
2019 Cole Fellow Amanda Malmstrom says a measure of mystique veils Emily Cole.
So in the 19th century, yes, there were limited opportunities for art instruction and exhibition, which were necessary to become a professional artist. But Emily had connections through her father. She was in conversation with artists such as Frederick Church and J.M. Falconer, and even her aunt Sarah Cole, which was one of the first generation of Hudson River School artists.
Malmstrom says despite limited opportunities for women to pursue an artistic career in her time, Cole emerged as an artist in her own right.
She studied at a New York City art school. We don't know exactly what one, and that's kind of the nature of Emily Cole. We have limited knowledge about her, yet the site owns this really exquisite corpus of her work. She received unofficial training from these artists she was in conversation with, yet did receive some formal training as well.
Most women in her time were confined to domestic roles. Many were allowed to express their artistic talents, but only as hobbies and never for income or other personal gain. But Cole's painted porcelain was exhibited in Catskill and New York City, and she became a charter member of the New York Society of Ceramic Arts. Like her father, Mancaneri says Cole lived and worked in Catskill, where she created an extensive collection of botanical illustrations.
We have in our collection over 100 watercolors on paper and painted porcelain objects, and they're really quite exquisite and delicate. A lot of the flowers and plant species that are in her watercolors and on the china, goldenrod, peonies, thistles, strawberries, are things that would have grown in her garden here and that are kind of part of the local landscape.
During her formative years, her father Thomas's trademark landscape painting was all the rage.
Emily was just 5 years old when her dad passed away, but Thomas had already recognized his daughter's kind of budding artistic interest, and he had a nickname for her, Miss Periwinkle. I think what's interesting about Emily's work is that she's paying close attention to botanicals, and she's working in a time, unlike Cole, where there's new ideas and new thinking in science. And certainly people have been studying botanicals and plant life for hundreds of years, but I think during Emily's time, this was a very popular thing.
According to the Thomas Cole Historic Site, Cole led her own movement of American flower painting, which emerged as a distinct genre in the mid-19th century as scientists and artists were influenced by European still life painting traditions and scientific discoveries. The Art of Emily Cole is on display at the Thomas Cole National Historic Site in Catskill through July 7. The exhibition, accompanied by a guided tour, is being presented in the 1815 main house where both Thomas and Emily Cole lived and worked. For 51%, I'm Dave Lucas.
In the wake of the Me Too movement, there's a renewed debate over the way some teaching hospitals treat women's bodies. Women who undergo anesthesia at those hospitals may be subject to pelvic exams without even knowing it. In most places, it's legal. Only 6 states, including Illinois, ban these exams. Medical schools argue it's necessary to teach students. But University of Illinois law professor Robin Fretwell Wilson wants to ensure women are allowed to give explicit consent. Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman asked Wilson about these exams and how often they occur.
Well, we actually don't have terrific data. What we have are accounts from medical students who say, I'm disturbed. Why aren't we having a conversation about this as in terms of medical ethics? We have residents saying that it was a normal teaching practice. And so we know the practice happens as a teaching matter. We know that often it's not consented to.
Does this happen only during something like a gynecological surgery or other surgeries as well?
Other surgeries as well. In fact, what sparked the opinion editorial and the call for maybe a sustained change was basically a woman reaching out to me from Arizona who went to the hospital for stomach surgery and then is told by a resident after the fact that medical students had done a gynecological exam. Well, there's some distance between your vagina and your stomach that's not necessary to the care that she received. It was done without her consent. And we hear those stories again and again from usually medical students saying they think that's what happened. Patients often don't know.
So related to that, I mean, Illinois is actually one of 6 states that bans non-consensual pelvic exams. I understand this was a result of public outcry over the issue that goes back to like the 1990s. And then what happened? Did the momentum just kind of fizzle out?
Well, so it seems like it goes in these spurts. There'll be a study or an ethics examination that says we're doing this, and then people go, you've got to be kidding me, right? We've had biomedical ethics for 30, 40 years. Certainly we don't do this. And then the answer back will be usually from students, well, I've been asked to do this, and I didn't feel right about it at the time. And then that will just sort of die out. And maybe laws were sort of passed in the interim. That happened after the Federal Trade Commission had hearings, and there were a set of laws that were passed. But if there isn't oversight by an accrediting body, if there's nobody like looking over the shoulder of attending physicians doing this work with medical students, then I think sometimes the easiest impulse is to say, yeah, why, nobody will care. We should just get on with it.
And so are you hoping that this issue will get revived, I guess, perhaps now in the wake of the Me Too movement?
I think so. I think sometimes we can make legal changes that are sophisticated, but without that oversight piece, tying it to accreditation, it's hard to operationalize. I think a lot of folks would be deeply, deeply disturbed by knowing that this might have happened to them or could possibly happen to them. So my hope is that we are thinking a lot harder about women's dignity in all kinds of ways, women's capacity and their autonomy. And this should be part of that broader discussion. And like the Me Too movement, I think just, you know, people saying, look, you need to ask, just ask, can be a way that we can get cultural change even when we don't have legal change. We've had this promise of informed consent and promise of autonomy about our bodies for 100 years. We need to make good on it, and we need to make good on it for people who usually are not, you know, in a terribly good position to do that for themselves.
That was University of Illinois law professor Robin Fretwell Wilson speaking with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman. Until recently, when the military issued uniforms to new recruits, they did not include sneakers. Instead, recruits chose their own. But a controversial new law has changed that. Recruits now are getting their first pairs of government-issued running shoes, which must be made in the USA. From San Antonio, Texas, Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
Sit on your duffel bag.
A group of new Air Force recruits is going through one of their first rites of passage, uniform issue. They've just arrived at Lackland Air Force Base, and trainers usher them around to different clothing stations.
I want you to put on both shoes, and I want you to tie them up, and I want you to get up and walk around. Yes, make ma'am. Sure the shoe is good for you.
The recruits file into a room stacked high with shoe boxes, where military clothing issuer Vernalyn Carter takes charge.
I can tell these are too snug.
Can I get a 15 regular?
sneakers became standard issue for the first time in January after a 2017 defense provision required the military to provide American-made athletic shoes. Three U.S. manufacturers, New Balance, Proper Footwear, and San Antonio Shoemakers, won contracts totaling almost $80 million. A long-standing law called the Berry Amendment requires that most of the military's uniform items be made in the U.S. The idea is to create American jobs and protect the supply chain in times of conflict. Carter, an Air Force retiree, understands it this way.
They didn't want things to be outsourced. They didn't want people to be in an American military wearing something that was made in China.
Still, for decades, sneakers were exempt from that rule. Instead, recruits were given about $90 to buy shoes themselves. The Pentagon argued U.S.-made shoes were too costly, too limited, and not durable enough to meet the military's needs. Greg Dutter of the industry trade magazine Footwear Plus says due to a lack of availability, the military postponed buying American for years.
I think the delay really might have had to do with the fact that nobody was making it. I mean, if you're talking about performance running shoe, nobody was making it into the volume that could meet that demand.
But by 2016, members of Congress began to take issue with the sneaker exemption. Some of the most vocal were from New England, home of New Balance, one of America's largest shoe manufacturers, which said it did have the capacity to make enough sneakers for the military. And then there was Martha McSally of Arizona, a veteran and longtime runner, who argued on the House floor that the Pentagon's buy-it-yourself approach gave recruits too much choice.
Right now, our recruits are getting injured because they're handed cash and they're told to go over to the BX and buy some shoes. Most of them have no idea. Am I a pronator? Am I a supernator? Do I have a high arch, a medium arch? They buy shoes based on price or based on which ones they think look good.
But there were others who defended sneaker choice during that 2016 congressional debate, including former reservist Mark Sanford, then a South Carolina congressman.
The military has allowed cash allowances for some time because they've recognized the need for personal choices in personal matters. For instance, women undergarments, people are allowed a personal choice in picking the undergarment that worked for them, and yet there's nothing more personal at the end of the day for a new recruit than their shoes.
The provision made its way into the defense budget, and it was a boon not only to New Balance, but to other smaller companies. The San Antonio Shoemakers factory now churns out hundreds of shoes each week for the military, and some of them end up right across town at Lackland Air Force Base. Production is sectioned off into a special area of the factory to ensure that foreign components don't make their way into the process. DJ Bubar is director of operations.
Most people don't realize how much work goes into a shoe. She has to put two rows of stitching around that, so it's very precise.
CEO Nancy Richardson says she's confident their product will meet the needs of new recruits.
Our shoemaking team especially was really excited and said, look, we make great shoes. We would love to supply a great shoe here. And so the team got the prototypes ready and we submitted the bid.
The Army, Coast Guard, Navy, and Marines will all start getting the shoes in the coming months. From now on, some 250,000 pairs will be distributed to recruits every year. In San Antonio, I'm Carson Frame.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. The first woman to be chief of the University Police Department at the State University of New York at New Paltz was sworn in recently. I spoke with Mary Rediak about her new role.
I mean, it feels awesome, you know. It's great to show that, you know, other women in this agency that, I, you know, you can do it. You keep your nose to the grindstone and you just show what you're capable of doing. And that gets you up the ranks, you know, and it's just the work that you do. So it's nice to show those, you know, that minority in the department. You know, you see the stats. It's like, what, 15% are women, so it's nice to reach this point and then mentor other females coming up the ring. I went to a training, Women in Leadership, in the Association of Police Chiefs, and it was just women. And a big thing was, you break that glass ceiling, you need to pull the other women up through it. So it was a great comment and a great way to think of it.
During her speech to an audience that included the Ulster County Sheriff and a number of local law enforcement officials, Rediak credited her father's advice with getting her into the field.
I would also like to thank my family here today, to my father, who told me one day long ago, take the civil service test, you never know. What do you got to lose? And a state job is a good gig. So speaking firsthand.
She had served as deputy chief in the University Police Department since 2013, adding interim police chief to her responsibilities in May, when Chief David Dugatkin stepped down. SUNY New Paltz President Dr. Donald Christian.
Of the SUNY University police chiefs currently, she's one of three women chiefs, and the first on our campus, the first woman leader on our campus. And you know, the significance there is that 88% of law officers, police officers around the country, across all agencies, are men. And a very small percentage of them are of the leadership are women, 3%, I think, something like that.
In her role as chief, Rydiak leads a newly accredited department of 22 sworn members and 6 civilian employees.
It's a tough line of work, and you know, you just keep going and you push through those problems and those issues that you may have, or you know, and then it's just a different role that you have within the department, and you kind of seem a little different, but you also have to show that you do the job the same way anybody else does, you know, and gender has nothing to do with it. You can go toe-to-toe with these people and still come out on top.
You are coming out on top, but were there obstacles, and if so, even generically, what?
I think my obstacle was kind of, can I do this? Can I, you know, kind of that, I don't know if I got this, or I don't know if I'm going to fit that mold, you know. So it's having other people say, you know, you can do this, and pushing me almost saying, you know, and then realizing I better do this, because if I don't, it's doing a disservice to other women in the department, other women in law enforcement, you know, like you're given an opportunity handed to you on a plate, you better take it.
She says women are generally seen as more approachable.
We're seen more open, my door's open, you can come chat with me, people feel more comfortable, I'm not big and muscular, you know, and even our officers who try to downplay that because they want people to come and approach them, but I think it's an approachable thing, you know, and I like that, you know, I like that people can feel like they can come to me, oh, that's a chief, you know, you can't talk to her, but you can, you know, you can see me walking across campus and say, I got a parking ticket, what the heck, you know.
President Christian speaks to what he sees as some of the challenges for the police chief.
Social media, the frustration that a lot of our students feel with national events that are sort of beyond their control, and yet they're issues that students care deeply about, and so they're finding ways that they can explore those issues and voice their views on them. We work really hard across the entire campus to try to build a strong sense of community where we respect difference and we navigate differences. University police play a key educational role in dealing with young people, and young people make mistakes. And that's part of the reason that being a university police officer is such a special role and special challenge. Because they're educators, they're working with a special population, and yet they need to be prepared as any other police officer is to do the things that police officers are called on to do.
Rydiak says it can be challenging to make the school students understand she and her department are there to help them.
We're not here to stifle them. We're not present at a protest to take a stance on one side. It's really to let them protest, but not get hurt. And you may get it, you know, a counter-protest that may have a different agenda than what you're just trying to say. So it's just trying to maintain the safest, but also have them, this is college, this is where you do those things, where you get that first feeling of, I want to do something about something in protest or bring it to somebody's attention. So we're here to help you do that in the best way you can, and not let it go awry and turn into something that turns unsafe for the community, not just for the protesters, but the people who work here and go to school here. You know, we want them to be able to do that, and we want to support that. So some people, they see us and they're like, oh, you're going to shut us down. You know, you don't want us to protest because you don't like the thought of the protest or what we're protesting about. And it's nothing to do with the content. We're just here to make you, you know, let you voice that.
Rydiak's fifth grade daughter, Samantha, attended her mother's swearing-in ceremony and describes what it's like to have her mother be the first woman to hold the position of police chief at SUNY New Paltz.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. What did you think when she told you?
I was surprised.
Why?
Because, like, I never thought that she could do that, and I never thought that she could have such a big job.
Do you think it sends a message?
Yeah.
What does it say?
Like that women can do anything and anything's possible.
SUNY New Paltz's student newspaper, the New Paltz Oracle, published an editorial January 31st entitled Chief Rydiak Carries the Torch for Future Female Leaders. Christian refers to this editorial.
They clearly recognize that with I think the quote was that 61% of our students are women, and this is empowering to them, and it's also supportive for them to think about what might be possible for them in the future in positions or roles or fields that have been heavily male-dominated.
That 61% figure reflects 2017, according to the editorial, which talks about the gender gap in both law enforcement and positions of power in general. Rydia Kaa's advice for young women thinking of entering a field dominated by men.
Go for it. I mean, you will have those struggles that, you know, and you have to have a thick skin. You do. You have to. And it kind of stinks that you have to, but you do, you know, and to just get through that, find a good mentor, find a good person you work with that you can express those concerns or issues and bounce ideas off of.
Did you have a female mentor?
I did. There was, you know, there was a captain that was here, Patty Castellano. She was here forever. She was a student, and she migrated into UPD. I think she worked for them as a student ticket writer, or, you know, a student worker, and she never left, and she was here for 30-something years, so... Yeah, and she was petite and soft-spoken, but we would go to the shooting range. She was an expert shooter. You know, just things like that you wouldn't think of until, you know, she handled any situation, quiet as can be, walked in calm, and people changed their tones, you know. So I just watched how she did things like that. And I'm like, oh, you don't have to come in pretend to be all, you know, I'm tough, I'm going to handle this, and, you know, overshow your what you can do.
Rydiak began her career in 1998 at the New York State University Police at SUNY Purchase, transferred to New Paltz in 2000, was promoted to University Police Investigator in 2003, and assumed the newly created role of Deputy Chief of Police in 2013. Mary Rydiak is now Chief of the University Police Department at SUNY New Paltz, the first woman to hold the position in the department's 50-year history. It's spring. It's spring. I already hear birds visiting the area that haven't been here in a good few months. So here's a question. Do male and female birds always look different? Well, we turn to BirdNote to find out.
This is BirdNote. In many species of birds, the male is far more colorful than the female. For instance, this male northern cardinal is a stunning bright red, while his mate is more subdued. But the males and females of many bird species look identical. You need look no further than the nearest flock of crows. They are all the same color and size, and all pretty much a mystery as to sex, at least to our eyes. The same is true of many common birds, from song sparrows to blue jays to cedar waxwings. Just how such variety has evolved, even among closely related species, is a topic of great scientific complexity. And advancements in technology reveal that birds that look similar may actually be quite different genetically. But even if we can't tell who's who, the birds can. Some scientists think crows may be able to tell each other apart by slight variations in their calls. And it's probable that crows and many other birds see differences in each other's feathers in the ultraviolet spectrum. Feathers that, to us, just look black. There's still so much we have to learn about birds. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1548.